We talked yesterday, we began thinking about the vastness of God's creation. And some of those people who are interested in astronomy, you know, realize how huge this universe is. And outer space seems to go on forever and ever. The nearest star to our star, Proxima Centauri, is 4.2 light years away, which is 24 trillion miles. And to get an idea how far that is, the astronauts that went to the moon took 3 days to get there, 240,000 miles. Those speeds, how long do you think it would take to get to the nearest star to our star?
Centuries.
800,000 years. So if we could go 10 times faster, it would be 80,000 years. If we go 100 times faster, 8,000 years. I have the viewpoint as a lay person, science kind of guy, I don't think we're ever going to get out of our solar system. That's just to the nearest star. And then it goes on and on. But what's fascinating, too, is not only is outer space apparently so vast, but inner space is, too. If you were to take a microscope and start looking, and getting smaller and smaller and smaller, used to think that atoms were the smallest thing. The word atom means atome. You can't cut it or you can't get any smaller. Well, now they know that there's particles smaller than that. Quarks and leptons and neutrinos. And not only is matter filled with that, but space is filled with that too. It's not really an empty space. So even inner space is apparently infinite as well. So the vastness of God's creation. And just on our particular planet, you know, all the different creatures. And hey, that's a good sign. You know, I have another jump drive here. Can we put it on yours?
Yes, we can put it on here.
Okay.
As soon as I figure out how to get into it.
And but not only is the creation vast, it's also ancient. And we talked about the universe being about 13.8 billion years old, and our planet about 4.6 billion, and life on Earth about 3.8 billion, single-cell life, and multiple-cell life about 660 million years. It's a long time. The reign of God has been going on a long time. And sea life moved on to land about 395 million years ago. And reptiles about 295 million. And mammals, which we are, about 195 million. And primates about 20 million. And our species about 200,000. A very short time that we've been here. And I mentioned if you were to push the underline button on your computer, and if you did that 19,000 times, and each one of those represented 200,000 years. That's how long life has been on Earth. And we've been there for one of those dashes. A very, very short time. So God's universe is vast, and God's universe is ancient. And we talked a little bit about that. The Earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We also talked about God creating the world good. My opinion, and that's just my opinion, and when I'm with my students, when I share my opinion, I say something like, this is my viewpoint. You can't have it. It's already taken. You got to find your own. My viewpoint is that God, there never was a perfection Eden or a paradise Eden. Never. God created the world tov, good. Remember in Genesis 1, God saw everything was made, and behold, it was good. And good is not perfection or paradise. That concept is actually a way to go. Wait a minute here. It's not quite the right one. quotes it out. Where's the list of? I hope I don't have anything bad that I'm here about churches I serve or something in my journal. There we go. We are almost ready. Okay, we just talked about this. Oh, in terms of the vastness too of God's creation, if you're a physics kind of person, you maybe can think about atoms and how a trillion atoms fit on the head of a pin. And the electrons go around the nucleus of an atom a trillion times in a trillionth of a second. And if you're into chemistry, you think about how some of those electrons join together to form compounds like H2O or carbon dioxide or NaCl salt. And if you're into biology, you think about how some of those compounds join together to form cells with enzymes and mitochondria and DNA. And if you're into physiology, you think of some of those cells joining together to form structures like bones and skin and hair and bodies. And if you're into ecology, you think about how some of those structures form together to form ecosystems, which are part of other ecosystems, which are part of other ecosystems, and how this vast and amazing world we have. And I talked about the creation is good. It's not perfect. There never has been a utopia. The Greek word utopia actually means no place. No place has never existed. God made the world total. And part of our problem, as we'll kind of get into here, is as human beings, we've come to think that total is not good enough. And so we've tried to remake the world. How are we doing so far? We talked a little bit about our particular creature, the human species, and how we're one of 20 million species. And the biblical stories, the one creation story, talks about the Adam coming from the Adama, the soil. We are made from the soil, from the dirt. We are dirtlings, earthlings. And who knows what the biblical writers meant by that. But I think that really ties well into evolutionary biology. We come from the soil. And then the second creation story, we talked a little bit about this phrase where God said, let us make humans in our image. In the sixth day, the storytellers have to have this in the narrative. And I suggested, people have always wondered who's us and who's our. And sometimes we thought it's a heavenly court of some kind or the Trinity or something like that. And I suggested the idea that maybe on the sixth day, as after God had made all the other creatures, God was actually talking to them and said, let us make humans in our image. And so that as human beings, we are made in the image of God and in the image of all other creatures on this earth. And we forget either at our peril, and our problem is we've forgotten one or both of the other. Now, I happen to think that all creatures are made in the image of God and in the image of all other creatures. That's just Ron's opinion. Again, who knows what these people were thinking? But that, too, for me, ties into what evolutionary biologists are telling us. We share, who's saying we share like 97% DNA with other primates? I think it's even higher than that. It's just amazing. And other creatures. Yeah. I was in South Africa at one point, and we got to tour a gold mine, and there we were, 1,000 meters underground. And I picked up a stone, and I asked the geologist that was with us, how old is this? And he said, 2.6 billion years old. Wow. Some of you maybe have been to Hawaii. You can walk on rock, molten or lava, after it's cool if you're walking it. It's not 2.6 billion years old, but is, you know, 30 minutes old. So the story of creation is going on even today. And we kind of wrestled with these questions a little bit. If the story of life is so long and so ancient and vast, if the reign of God has been here for billions of years, why are Judaism and Christianity so recent? Only 4,000 years old or 2,000 years old? Even for our species, we're 200,000 years old. Why are those so recent? Yes?
Because God doesn't want to hear all that arguing.
Okay. And then the other question, why does the message of the Old Testament and the New Testament at its core seem to be declaring the reign of God? That this is the Lord's world. And why does that message seem to be addressed to our species? And the thesis that I'm coming up with is that it's because our species is the one that has forgotten the reign of God. Talked about this theory that several thousand years ago, after living a couple hundred thousand years in the species, and we know so little of that time, right? So little. Of the many thousands of cultures around the planet, a few of those human cultures started to go nuts. And they started to go nuts in the sense that they started to adopt a different narrative for who they are. And the narrative was, rather than the earth belonging to the whole community of life, including our species, the new worldview mindset was, the earth belongs to our species. And we talked about how that sort of change in from being in relationship and seeing ourselves as part of the whole was changed to seeing ourselves as separate from, superior to, the reason for, and the rulers. Man is the measure of all things. We became conquistadors as this started to infect our species. We became dominators. We became takers. And I introduced the notion of takers and leavers. A taker is someone who takes and takes and takes. A leaver is someone who takes what they need and leaves the rest. And part of this change was moving from the leaver worldview to a taker worldview. And I suggested that this is what the biblical fall stories are about. This new way of thinking that put humans at the center had started to emerge in a few cultures 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000 years ago. And at the time of the biblical storytellers, about 3,000 years ago, some of those folks with that new worldview were showing up at their doorstep. And they started to wonder, you know, what's wrong with these people? They seem to think the world revolves around them. They think that they're at the center and everything else is there to serve them. Well, they created parables then. Maybe they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is another way of saying maybe they crossed the line of differentiation between creator and creature, and now they think they're on the creator's side. They think they are like God. After 200,000 years under the reign of God, we declared the reign of humans. Another way to say this is, as a species, we began to leave the Creator's house under the sustaining and permeating reign of God, and instead declared our own house under the dominating and domineering reign of humans. And I'm suggesting that this might be what the fall stories are about. And so, it wasn't that there were two people named Adam and Eve. I think for most of us, we don't take a literal view of that. That's not what we're taught in seminaries. But also, the stories are not purely symbolic. They're not just talking about kind of in general what's wrong with humans. The stories are actually meant to address historical things happening in the storyteller's lives, where they're starting to see this new worldview infiltrating their community. And they're starting to see denigration happen because of that. Because humans, in this new worldview, are starting to see themselves as primary. Now, I suppose if we believed in six-day creation 6,000 years ago, that humans came on the sixth day, you know, we've been here the whole time except the first 5 days, it might make sense to put ourselves at the center. But we understand, at least in my view, how we've been here this long. In God's universe and the reign of God, we're on one tiny speck of a planet, in one little tiny arm of the one galaxy, out of 200 billion galaxies. To make it all about us, I think is, I won't go through this again, but we kind of look through this timeline starting with, and see how recent these religions are, and how recent we are.
What's the difference between modern Homo sapiens and Homo sapiens?
Sapiens, yeah. Language, and then the ability to think symbolically. That's what they... Apparently we had the physical anatomy earlier than 70,000 years ago, but some kind of transformation started to happen about 70,000 years ago, and language... something about our larynx that enabled language to, it's high up, that enabled language. Sometimes this new worldview is called human exceptionalism. Sometimes called anthropo-narcissism. A friend of mine calls it diva theology. And as we have begun to live that way, live that narrative, and I'm calling that the taker narrative, Cain narrative, rather than the Abel narrative, the leader narrative, we've grown more and more out of relationship with God's creation, more out of relationship with our neighbor, out of relationship with the inner spirit, and out of relationship with the ground of it all, of creating. That worldview is the garden was made for humans. You know, people kind of say, well, there's people, and then there's the environment. I mean, I would argue that 99.9% of everything we hear in every textbook, every newscast, every graduation speech, every story mom and dad tell their kids is framed as though there's humans and then there's everything else. And I would argue that there is only the environment, which includes humans. We feel that we must conquer it. You know those two guys there, Tenzin Norgay and Edmund Hillary? What did they do? So when Edmund Hillary died in 2008, I think it was a newspaper article that said that they had conquered Everest. Anybody ever been on a high mountain? That's the last thing you do is conquer that. I mean, you're a little speck on this huge thing. But that's part of our worldview that we've got to do. We think that we must rule it, use it as desired, and discard the rest as expendable. I heard a Christian preacher on the radio driving to church one day who said, the earth is like a paper towel. Use it up and throw it away. Yeah. It's all going to be destroyed anyway. Yeah. Where is that coming from? Well, he was reflecting our culture, I think. Many cultures, not just ours. We should not stop our quest to command land, sea, sky, weather, wildlife, bacteria, genes. Until this holy mission is fulfilled and creation lies bleeding at our feet. Until we have transformed both God and nature into our image. All creation is born in each other. Do you want to read Hosea here?
Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel. For the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty and no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, and murder, and stealing, and adultery break out, bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns, and all who live in it languish. Together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea are perishing.
And I'm going to suggest that death is, we talk about even the told world includes death. Death is a natural part of the way that God made the world. Because if nothing died, we'd have a lot of stuff around here, including a lot of us. And that, we'll get into Jesus tomorrow, but that Jesus did not come to overcome death. I know we use that language. I've used it. What Jesus did was come to overcome perishing. And to be perishing is to be out of relationship with my neighbor. And to be perishing is to be out of relationship with the creation. And to be perishing is to be out of relationship with my own inner spirit and soul and self. And to be perishing is to be out of relationship with God the Creator. And so there can be people walking around today alive who are still perishing. Someone could have died this morning. Not be perishing at all. We'll talk more about that distinction. So, I'm kind of suggesting this false story is a recent story. That humans did fine the first couple hundred thousand years. It's only recently that we've done that. And the biblical false stories are written recently, like 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, to address this going nuts. Yep.
I know next to nothing about archaeology in this school, but have you read anything that connects like the development of tools and some of these technological advances contributing to the nutsness, or what's the relationship?
It could, yeah. the distinction I like to make, you know, in agriculture too. We tend to think agriculture started 10,000 years ago. No, it had been going on long before that. But I think maybe what the difference was, I talk about it from moving from kind of agriculture to totalitarian agriculture. Working with the earth to dominating the earth. I mean, that's a whole question there too. What is we know so little. Our ancestors didn't use plastic that lasts for 1,000 years. You know, they all had baskets and wood and so forth that degrade. So we don't have a lot of evidence.
Yes. Is this? Are you thinking of this Mayan civilization? Everything I know about Native American, they seek to navigate foreign islands.
Yeah.
So, with all cultures?
I think what we know about some of the Native indigenous peoples of the world, and we don't want to idealize them or romanticize them because they got into fights and they had difficulties. But I think there is a major difference. Their fights were at least kept kind of as part of the community of life, and that held it in check. It's only when we started to separate ourselves that now we are an unchecked species. And I think a lot of those indigenous peoples just had a better sense of connectedness and relationship with the creation. And that tying into the Cain and Abel story, we think of Abel as those indigenous peoples.
When you Cain, your takers,
yeah.
With all of the building.
Yeah.
To me, they're still takers prior to this Cain and Abel split. And that, the bottom of it, doesn't seem as consistent with the flip over or change.
Well,
they're still killing each other and taking from each other. But again, we have anthropological evidence, and we have some part of the Elohim Christ.
One example is the buffalo. Okay, Abel killed buffalo, and used it for meat, used it for hides, used it for tents. Sometimes even Abel killed more buffalo than they needed because they sometimes brought them to the edge of the cliff and then had them fall off, and it was some ways. But Abel would never, I don't think, have thought, let's bring this species to extinction. There's something different there. And I'm arguing that that's a Cain. And so once Cain came on the scene, whenever he found Abel, he rose up to kill him. And so you can imagine, you can think about all the Cains and how we have dealt with the indigenous peoples of the world. And even today, whenever Cain or Abel is discovered, we somehow rise up to kill him or tame him.
Example?
In the Amazon now. There's peoples there that have been undiscovered. We're starting to discover them. Is that going to be good for them? I don't know.
There were people in Guinea fighting over turf long
before
any of this happened.
I know. Well, yeah. I'm not saying that Abel was perfect. At all. The saddest verse of the Bible. Can someone read this?
The Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth humankind that I have created.
So the 13.7 billion years happened between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 6:6. Apparently, the biblical storytellers started to experience this change they wrote stories that indicated to them that God is not so happy with this either. And God, the Creator, had a dilemma. What should I do with this creature? Destroy them? Or try to heal? Apparently, God must have decided, and this comes from Daniel Erlander's book, Manna and Mercy. Wonderful, wonderful book. God must have decided, well, can a mother kill one of her children? Can a father destroy his kids? And why would I want to act like Cain? So instead of destroying us, God apparently decided to try to heal us. So God's primary mission, the evolving story of life, has been going on for a long, long time. At least 13.7 billion years. Recently, God took on a secondary mission, and that was to try to deal with a wayward species and try to heal them and bring them back, restore them to God's primary mission. And this is gospel, I think, is the word that we can use. So the question is, how to do that? And the rest of the Bible, after Genesis 6:6, I think is that story of how God is trying to heal us and bring us back into the Father's house under the permeating reign of God. A couple of books to recommend here, Man of Mercy, that I suggested. Anybody heard of Scott Gustafson? It's a great book on helping us to think about biblical stories that we know and recalling, wait a minute, I didn't quite get that. There's more there than I had seen. So how is God going to heal us? Well, first of all, God tries a flood. Now, I happen to believe that this is a parable, that it's not history. And a couple reasons for that. I don't think there's a geosciences or geology department in the world at any university that says that there was a time in the Earth's history when humans were here that the Earth was covered with water. In fact, if you take the biblical story, it was so high that it covered not only Mount Ararat, which is 16,000 feet tall in Turkey, but Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet tall. Now, there have certainly been floods, and there continue to be today. This is part of the total world of God, the good world. But I just personally don't think that this is an historical event. I think it's a parable. And of course, we understand parables to not have been things that happened, but things that are nevertheless true. And so, what's the point then of this flood story? The parable has a point. Perhaps the point is, if you think you can get rid of bad people by killing off bad people, think again. Because Noah and his clan sort of pick up the slack pretty quick. Pretty quick. And not only does Noah make a winery and get fall down drunk and fall asleep naked in his tent, but when his son Ham sees him, Noah is so kind of self-loathing that he does what we often do when we don't like ourselves, we project it on someone else, that he curses his son's descendants, Canaan, to slavery. And of course, when slavery was in Europe and this country, people looked at those verses and said, see, it's in the Bible. You people are supposed to be slaves. God tried a flood parable. It didn't quite work. God tried a chosen people. Well, maybe if I can find somebody and I can teach them how to live, they could become a model for others of their species, and maybe I can get this species fixed up a little bit. So God found people that were slaves in Egypt, a scrappy bunch of people, and he was going to teach them how to live. They were living in Egypt, and Egypt is a pretty good example of Cain's world. You got at the top, you got these people. A few of them. They have the power, they have the access. And down here, more and more of the workers, the farmers, the teachers, the plumbers, the computer scientists. and you have the slaves and people working for slave labor, wages, where you're stuck. And you have the surrounding poor nations. Cain likes to reach into other nations and get their resources, whether they're minerals or persons who will work cheap, or you can put your plant there and get them to work cheap. And at the bottom, it's the community of life in this pyramid world. And this was the world that the Israelites were living in Egypt. And God decided to take them. Now here's sort of a, would someone read this? This is kind of a...
In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of mountains. It shall be raised above the hills, all nations shall stream to it. Many people shall say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and lead to the world, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord, Jerusalem, shall judge between the nations, and shall arbitrate for many nations. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war.
So God found this people, and he sent them, well, let's continue. The story begins with kind of five heroes. Shipra and Pua. Remember the Pharaoh said, okay, when these Hebrew women have babies, I want you to kill them. These are the midwives, Shipra and Pua. What did they do? They said, the old man's nuts. We're not going to follow him. They didn't do it. They dared to resist Pharaoh. And when Pharaoh called them on it, they said, wow, gee, those Hebrew women, they have babies so fast. When we get there, they've already been done. Then Pharaoh said, well, whenever there's a male baby born, throw him in the Nile. Well, Jochebed had a baby boy. She threw him in the Nile. And she made a little basket first. So she had the courage to disobey Pharaoh. Miriam, older sister, she hung out on the shoreline, watched the basket. And when Pharaoh's daughter came down, remember what Miriam did? Once Pharaoh's daughter found the baby, she said, oh, a baby. Oh, you know, I think I know a Hebrew woman who's still giving milk because she had a baby recently. I'll go get her and maybe she can feed this baby for me. And who was that woman? Moses' mom. So Miriam had the courage to disobey Pharaoh. And even Pharaoh's daughter, I don't know, she must have known what was going on. So you work it out. So God took them and brought them to 40 years of wilderness school in the Sinai Desert. That's a Daniel 11 place. To teach them how to live the way God wants us to live. It doesn't need a model for us. The problem was the chosen people, you know, they sometimes saw their special service chosen as special status. Law, too, was one of the remedies that God tried. And law is a funny thing. We need law. Oh, there we go. I'm going to come back. 40 years of wilderness school. And part of that was law. And we need law, but it also has its downsides. It can bring out the worst in us. And we can make laws, and the laws are used to enslave people. Laws are used to trash the earth. They can be twisted. Maybe remember this old story that I heard in some old sermon illustrations about a family that had three kids, and mom and dad, they needed to go into town and get some groceries, so they left the three kids at home. In the afternoon, they said, "Whatever you do, don't put a penny up your nose." So they go into town, buy the groceries, come back 3 hours later. Sure enough, one of the kids has a penny up their nose. Another has a nickel up his nose. And the third one didn't do either of those, but was a holy terror in every other way while they were gone. I mean, we understand as kind of Lutherans how the law doesn't necessarily make us bad people. There's even the story of kings. One of the things that I was reminded in this biblical amnesia book is that, you get this from 1 Samuel, the idea of a monarchy was not God's idea. In fact, God was against it. It was like the Israelites had been living in the period of the Judges, and they were kind of going back and forth between Abel's and Cain, and sometimes they'd be Abel, and sometimes they'd go with Cain. But after a couple hundred years of living fairly well, they started to notice their neighbors. And their neighbors seemed to have, on the surface anyway, more power and more wealth and more kitchen appliances. Maybe it's because they have a king. So they came to Samuel and said, "We want a king." And Samuel said, "No, you don't. God's your king." "No, we want a king." They kept after him. Finally, Samuel was praying to the Lord. They said, "Lord, what am I going to do? They're rejecting me. They want a king." And the Lord says, "No, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me." So they tried the monarchy. First there was Saul. He started out pretty well. Pretty soon he was corrupt to the core. And David came after him. Started out pretty well. But he became awfully corrupt. And this particular story of the rape of Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. And I use the word rape because, I don't know, when the king's soldier knocks on your door and says, "Come to the king," and the next verse is he lay with her, that doesn't seem like an equal relationship. It's a power thing. And then when he finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant, he tries to get Uriah home on leave from the war and hopes that they'll sleep together, and Uriah doesn't do that. And then he puts Uriah in the front line of the next battle. And Uriah is killed. So murder. And I think it's important to remember that this is not only a story of personal failing on David's part. think it's a metaphor for Cain's way of being in the world. A pyramid. This is how it functions in sort of a molesting and killing kind of way. Solomon, too, also started out really well. As a little boy, he prayed for wisdom. Very nice, touching story. He became pretty corrupt awful fast. Anybody know what the word concupiscence is? It means gather all things unto myself. That's Solomon. He was a consumer. And in order to do that, you need to have warfare with your neighbors, because you need to get their resources. And he had 700 wives and 300 girlfriends, concubines. One person said, well, is that necessarily a good thing? And he built the temple using slaves. Can you imagine anything more contrary to God? Building the temple supposedly to God using slaves. So, in 100 years, everything had come full circle. Solomon had become just another Pharaoh, and Israel just another Egypt. Monarchy produced Cain's way of being in the world of paganism. Sometimes we look at the 100-year period as sort of the glory years of Israel. Scott Gustafson's book, Biblical Amnesia, helped me to see, I don't think those were the glory years. In fact, there was some pretty awful things happening. So God had tried the flood, chosen people, law, kings, prophets, wealth. Maybe if I scare the living daylights out of these people, they'll show up. But the problem with that tactic is it works for a little while, but you can't keep it up. And the alarm system just doesn't work forever and ever. So the prophets didn't particularly work either. So what to do? God's got this world, God's got a big responsibility, this whole universe, and this little planet Earth, pretty big responsibility, all 20 million creatures. One of them is just a little bit wacko and is hurting everything. I can't wipe them out. I'm going to try to fix them. Tried a number of things. Is there anything left? Over time, God sent many Abels to try to teach the people. Sometimes in the form of rabbis, wise men, prophets, people on the margins. Even the community of life. There's a picture during the Gulf oil spill, and I haven't been able to find it, but there were two dolphins sort of poking their head up out of the oil slicked water, looking towards a burning fire on the surface of the ocean, and just kind of wondering what in the world is going on here. Well, as you can see, tomorrow we're going to be looking at the Jesus story. And framing that story kind of coming out of what we've been talking about here. And that, in a sense, the Old Testament prepared the way, but in a sense, the Old Testament fell short. And in the Jesus event, when you look at what that means. And there might be some surprises there. Okay, Liddy, what are some thoughts and what's rolling through your mind here?
Well, I just think, you know, irrespective of the anthropological history and who did what when, I think the Cain and Abel story that's described here really does a good job of helping us look at our culture and analyze what we do and why we do it from a different perspective. And we look at all these things and are trying to solve environmental problems, being one of the examples, and everybody thinks about the future of the environment, and it's gloom, doom, despair. We need to do something different. I think everybody agrees with that. And I think it's really helpful to kind of look at different models and draw upon spiritual ideas for doing that. And I think it really does apply to what can a spiritual community do to help with the environmental crises that are happening.
I'm always thinking of how Judeo-centric that whole story is, knowing that there are these other cultures going on. I have this yearning to look at those cultures' perception of what's going on. Oh my gosh, you could really show the people, but how about, you know, think about it, because the same process is going to
get an interesting insight maybe with the Babylonian captivity and how we deal with prisoners and then which culture was going to help it, but there's not a lot of what was going on in those places. Yeah, that's the interesting question. Which is true.
I'm reading a novel by Isabel Allende that's filled with border crossings, but it includes a Western doctor and an Eastern Chinese doctor who does acupuncture back in the mid-1800s, and they're learning from each other, and the Chinese doctor keeps telling him how much more ancient everything he has and learns from and much more indigenous. And I'm intrigued by that, kind of going back into the way they look at the body differently. But that there's some wisdom, and it was shamed. It was, you know, for so many years, it was really put down. And I'm interested, my grandpa was a medical missionary in China back in the 1800s ago. But how things get shamed, and then they may be where there is some wisdom.
Ron, how do you respond to the charge that the problem is not Cain, but God? And that theism has authored so much of the destruction. He was.
We're going to talk about Abel of Nazareth. Abel of Nazareth. And how Abel of Nazareth has been changed into Cain of Nazareth. Maybe Constantine had something to do with that. We'll look at that.
You came to my mind as I was listening to the Bible study that with Abel of Nazareth, with Jesus giving permission for legions to go into all the swine. The swine are equal.
Yeah, that wasn't very nice to the swine, was it?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a heck of a wiener roast that night, though.
Some what?
They had a heck of a wiener roast that
yeah.
night.
Yeah. Okay. Think about what God's going to do to kind of take the next step here and start.